appearing on behalf of Matakoni Lodge, and I'm here today with Ms. Rebecca Holden, who has done some planning evidence in this matter. Rebecca's also appearing on behalf of some other submitters, but my submissions only relate to Matakoni Lodge. And so Matakoni Lodge is a world-class luxury lodge located on the shores of Lake Waikatupu. You should have some legal submissions from me dated 12th of September.
Yes.
I also sent through a copy of the Gladding and Queenstown Lakes District Council case. I'm not sure whether that made it well. And you'll have a copy of Ms. Holden's statement of evidence, as well as a summary statement, which I think has now just been circulated. Now, I've assumed that you've pre-read the evidence and submission, so I don't intend to read them word for word. And so I'm going to make a couple of minor corrections to my submissions and then highlight a couple of key points.
Okay.
And then I'll answer any questions to the extent I'm able, and I'll leave any planning assessment matters to Ms. Holden to respond to. So just in terms of the corrections, just a couple of minor points. Paragraph 8 of my legal submissions, I'd just like to amend that, that doesn't quite make sense, to read, the only issue on which MLL is seeking a determination from this hearings panel is how visitor accommodation should be defined. I can read that again. And then paragraph 9, just in the quote there, I was copying it across, there should be, in the first paragraph of the quote where it says 3 months and it's struck out and then it's got 90 days underlined, I believe the version also needed to have the words days struck out in it, to be completely accurate.
Oh, I see. So
Thank you. All right. So in terms of the key points, so as I mentioned, Matakoni Lodge, and I'm just looking at my paragraphs 1 to 4 of my legal submissions here, is a world-class luxury lodge located on the shores of Lake Waikatupu. And it's owned by the Robertson family, and they also own and manage 2 other luxury lodges, one in Hawke's Bay, Cape Kidnappers, and one in Northland, Cody Cliffs. They've also got the Dry River Wines winery and a substantial farming block. They've also just recently purchased a property on Waikiki Island where they will be establishing another visitor accommodation facility. So Matakoni Lodge has undergone significant refurbishment and investment since it was purchased, and it now comprises 4 different accommodation options, and it's got a restaurant, a spa, and it organises packages. And the reason I mentioned the restaurant and spa is because obviously the activities which fall within the scope of the visitor accommodation definition is something that's been raised as an issue by some of the submitters. So for Matakoni, they actually have a resource consents that allow those facilities to operate, but I wanted to just bring that to your attention. So the reason why Matakoni is here today is to basically support the definition of visitor accommodation as it was proposed by the council and with the minor amendments made in the Section 42A report, and the differentiation from residential visitor accommodation and homestays. And the key points really that my submissions pick up on is that there is no standard definition of visitor accommodation in different plans, and councils are free to adopt their own. I did a bit of a scan across a number of different plans, and I think there might have been only 2 of the 10 that I looked at that had similar definition. All of the rest had different definitions. I'm aware that the planning standards, the draft national planning standards, do have the definition of visitor accommodation, and that doesn't refer to any ancillary activities. It's really quite broad and high level, but nor does it say that they cannot be included. In my submission, a definition of visitor accommodation should address the reality on the ground and be broad enough to include all activities associated with visitor accommodation. It needs to be fit for purpose and in particular fit for the special Queenstown environment. So the fact that the definition might differ from other councils, in my view, is not as much of an issue as making sure that it's fit for the purpose here. It needs to be clear so that plan users and visitor accommodation providers, neighbours, etc., understand the scope of the activities that are covered by visitor accommodation and that they can order their lives accordingly. It also needs to reflect the importance that visitor accommodation and the ancillary activities are to Queenstown, and I know that Ms Holden addresses that point in her evidence. In terms of the submissions, and in particular the submission of Ms Gladding, I was listening to the recording of her appearance and I read through her material, and I understand her concern is really around the definition of visitor accommodation, including ancillary activities, and the fact that there is no scale or limits proposed in the definition itself. And in my view, it would be inappropriate in a definition to include the limits on the scale and those sorts of things, given the different scope of the activities that come within the visitor accommodation, from sort of lodges like Monte Cote to hotels. And what is ancillary to the different activities will depend on the size, scale and type of visitor accommodation. And the rules, that the effects of the activities can then be controlled through the rules. So that's more appropriate than trying to put that into a definition in my submission. So those are just the key points I was wanting to raise from my submissions, and then just that response to Ms Gladding's submission.
No, I don't think you have
No, that's very clear.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll turn it over to Ms Holden to go through her summary. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. You have my summary in front of you. I've just summarised my main evidence. So I'm here representing the submitters listed on the front of my evidence in chief. So they are submitters 2611 to 2614 and 2616 to 2617. So these submitters have made a submission on the proposed variation of stage one P2P chapters in relation to visitor accommodation provisions. Each of these submitters own land which has an existing and or historical visitor accommodation use within their respective sites. As such, these submitters seek that the VA subzone be applied or confirmed over their land. These submitters also support the definition of visitor accommodation as notified, as well as the introduction of residential visitor accommodation and homestay definitions to differentiate between the definition of visitor accommodation. I note that within the Section 42A reports authored by Ms. Devman and Ms. Bovies, on behalf of the Queensland Lakes District Council, a recommendation is made that the panel accept those submitters' requests, with the exception of submitter 2614, which was Dallas Investments Limited, whereby the recommendation is for the panel to reject the relief sought by the submitter. The relief sought by Dallas relates to land located at 9 South Berg Avenue, Fracton, containing what was once a former motel complex. Since the early 1990s, this property has been used for residential purposes, a situation that was never legally formalised until recently, when resource consent was obtained to reflect that historical situation. Although a visitor accommodation subzone is shown on planning maps within the operative district plan, the stage 2 variation excludes this overlay, locating the site wholly within the lower density suburban residential zone. Submission 2614, Dallas, is supported on the basis that the visitor accommodation subzone reflects the existing built form and historical use of the site. I therefore consider that there is some benefit in applying the subzone to the site. I am of the view that the underlying bulk and location provisions within the decision version of Chapter 7 of the PDP will ensure that the existing character and amenity values within this lower density suburban residential zone will be retained, with the matters of discretion within the notified rule 7.4.17, placing parameters around the nature and scale of any future visitor accommodation activity, if the site is to be redeveloped. In terms of the notified definition of visitor accommodation, I support this definition being confirmed as notified with the minor changes recommended by Ms. Bovies in her Section 42A report. It is my view that the district's economy depends on services and facilities within visitor accommodation facilities, such as conference facilities, bars, restaurants, etc., which are utilised by people not staying at the venue. The nature and scale of these ancillary services or facilities is controlled through the zone provisions, where council has the ability to impose appropriate conditions of consent.
Just a couple of brief questions. The residential activity on the Delos investment site,
yeah.
I mean, it appears to have been there for some time. Do
yeah.
you know when it changed from being a motel back to being residential?
The only record on council file is a handwritten note on a piece of paper that's been scanned, and it dates back to the early 1990s.
So sometime before that?
Yeah, it was the early 1990s. So I think that was either 1993, I think that was.
And do you know, when were they built?
Well, the consent was, I think it was 1970-something.
All right.
Yeah.
And in the operative plan, what's the activity status of motels or visitor accommodation in the sub-zone?
The sub-zone. Good question. It's either, I think it's controlled or restricted discretionary. I can't recall off the top.
But in the proposed visitor accommodation subzones, albeit not applied over this site,
yeah.
It's restricted discretion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. That's all my questions, thank you.
Yes, just what, how would the existing Dulles Motel operation fare under the rules as they currently stand in the proposed plan? Things like travel generation or parking standards.
Under the proposed plan?
Yep.
So the
visitor accommodation?
There is a parking shortfall, I think, but it's only, I think it's 2 spaces from memory.
The reason I ask that question is it does look, they look quite dated, I suppose.
Wondering, Ms. Holden, whether, from a planning point of view, whether the fact that something was gained a consent, as you said, under the 1953 Planning Act, and then 25 years ago ceased to exercise that consent, whether we should really be concerned about that as a reason to zone it now. I mean, it's a bit like all sorts of things might have got consents under the 53 Act, which, you know, more than 25 years ago ceased to exist. We haven't rushed around the district, making sure they've all got zoning consistent with the 1973 consent, have we?
There is the 2018 consent that's recently been issued in July for the visitor accommodation on that site. So then Dallas does have an existing use to reinstate their visitor accommodation activity, but only for a period of 5 years if they don't give effect to it. However,
that's standard with all consents.
Yeah, I'm just saying that it is relevant now in terms of that right has been reissued. But the bulk and location, the built form, sorry, that's what I'm trying to say, the built form of what's there now although dated, reflects, is more conducive to a visitor accommodation purposes than residential. And as part of both of those underlying consents, both residential and visitor accommodation, huge upgrades need to be carried out, especially in terms of acoustic insulation requirements, because it is, the site is located within the out of control boundary.
Now what? Clearly if it has a consent, it has a consent for the conditions, what would be the effect of putting a VA subzone over it? Would it mean they wouldn't need that consent and they could do something else?
No, they'd still need that consent, but if the development aspirations of the submitter, if they were to redevelop the site for that purpose, for visitor accommodation purpose, it would be a lot more difficult if the VA subzone was not.
So the consent doesn't enable redevelopment?
No, not of the built form, no. Just the use.
So then the VA subzone would allow more intense activity?
Not necessarily, but potentially. Yeah. It would allow them to update the appearance of the built form, because it is stated.
No, that's all.
Okay, thank you. Well, one thing, if we have a copy of that consent,
which one?
I think it's attached to your.
Oh, attached
to the evidence.
Both
consents.
Yeah, both the recent, right. The 2017 and 2018 consents are attached.
Oh, yes, it is.
Thank you. And I meant to say before I started before that I appreciated the committee rescheduling our appearance from last Monday when the snow came and stopped Mr. Wells being able to leave his house and the airport being shut. So thank you.
Almost had one of the commissioners was unable to hear anything.
That was 3 months earlier.
I'm appearing today for RCL Henley Downs, and again standing in for Mike Holm and Rowan Ashton on this one. And RCL has extensive land holdings in Jacks Point, you're probably familiar with them. And in terms of documents, you should have my legal submissions dated 12th of September. There's no cases mentioned in those submissions. You'll have a statement of evidence from Mr. Wells dated the 6th. August, and you should just have that one-page summary which he has just handed round.
Yes.
That one-page summary includes one correction or update to his evidence, which does affect my submissions, and I'll just touch on that shortly. As before, I assume you've pre-read the evidence and submissions, so I don't intend to go through them in any detail. I just want to talk to a couple of key points and answer any questions. The details of the specific relief being sought by RCL and the extent to which any relief remains live will be addressed by Mr. Wells. In terms of corrections, so in paragraph 6 of my legal submissions, there's just in the second line, there's in is repeated twice, so just deleting the second in. And then moving to paragraph 10, just wanting to delete the last sentence of paragraph 10. And that's a consequential amendment arising from a change that Mr. Wells is making to his evidence shortly. Right. So in terms of the key points in my legal submissions, really the thrust of what I've got there is that in my submission, development contributions are more appropriate than financial contributions for seeking to recover costs of infrastructure beyond the site, and that's consistent with the council's development contributions policy. It's consistent with the life of the plan being 10 years and financial contributions are being phased out in 2022. There's also a need for certainty in plan provisions, and I think in my opinion, having when the plan was originally notified with a reference to something that sounded like a financial contribution, there was a degree of uncertainty, and I noticed that that has been remedied to a substantial extent by Ms. Jones's rebuttal evidence. The only change that we would look at in terms of that wording proposed by Ms. Jones was around in the vicinity or beyond the site. It's what the vicinity is unclear, and that could be immediately adjoining, immediately adjacent, it could be within 2Ks, 10Ks. And there's a risk that when you've got, so I guess the first point is that there's an issue around the certainty and clarity as to what that means. And then the second point is that if it does mean that off-site traffic upgrades could be required, then there's a potential for those to double up with the development contributions regime. And in my submission, off-site traffic improvements can still be offered by a developer through, for example, a development agreement process, but they shouldn't be required. And I know this is an assessment criteria now, it's not a rule requiring a traffic upgrade, but I am aware that quite often assessment criteria are relied on in terms of formulated conditions, in terms of what needs to be done to mitigate effects. So that's basically it in terms of that. So it's about proposing a bright line test. If something's on the site, absolutely it can be it's the subject of a requirement. If it's beyond the site, then what we're proposing here is that there is delineation, and the appropriate delineation comes from development contributions which would cover beyond the site rather than inside the site itself.
Okay, just in terms of this issue of development contribution versus financial contribution, it has been put to us by the council that this high traffic generation law enables a substitution for parking and exceptional requirements that are required by other things. So is the parking that is required a financial contribution?
That's a good question, because I guess it would depend if it came within the definition of what is infrastructure.
Because that makes it difficult for every district in the country, doesn't it?
Yes, no, I just focused on what the improvements would mean for the road rather than the parking in terms of a car park. I might defer to see what Mr. Wells has to say on that.
The other thing is, if the purpose of the provision is to enable a relaxation of those standards but the substitution of something else, What is the problem with it from a developer's point of view? If the purpose of the rule, as explained to us, is to enable a reduction in fixed standards and the substitution of that reduction by alternatives, then what is the problem with the rule? Apart from the issue potentially of uncertainty that you've raised, but in terms of the purpose, is there a legal error in having that purpose?
There's not a legal error on its face. I just think there is the potential, as I said, for the uncertainty between the wording of the, and I think it's not a rule now, is it? It's an assessment criteria in terms of the wording that I've been talking about. And the potential for, I guess, the what a developer pays under a development contribution versus what they're required to do as a condition of consent. That's where that sort of line is drawn, is really the concern that I have, and that's not.
Do they have to provide, for example, provide parking as well as the development contribution? Council was saying we can reduce the parking if you do something in this state.
Not sure how I can take that much further.
I don't necessarily have a straight answer, but I can talk to that point when it comes up. So good afternoon. I imagine you've read my initial evidence, so I'll just quickly go through the summary. I summarise the key points of my evidence as follows. Concern at the potential imposition of financial contributions. Concern at the inefficiencies resulting debate / litigation over reasonable off-site transport upgrades. A preference that the plan continue to state minimum car parking standards on all activities, regardless of scale, but that it explicitly anticipate breaches to those where the likes of travel demand management measures will be implemented. Opposing reference to requiring the installation of electric vehicle charging stations. Support for recommended amendments that would allow consideration of urban design matters when considering breaches of minimum distances from access ways from intersections. Support for allowing car parks or residential flats to be parked in tandem with other car parks in a residential unit. Suggestions around improving wording and making the chapter more concise. Concern that in a suburban residential environment such as Hanley Downs, there would appear to be few if any realistic travel demand management measures that could be installed that are not already to be provided for by the plan's provisions. Having to undertake integrated transport assessments could therefore create additional work for the benefit. Therefore, a recommendation that if the concept of high traffic generating activities is to remain in the plan, that it not encapsulates standard residential subdivisions of this nature. Concern that provisions may extend the scope of transport upgrades beyond the site of a consent in a manner that may constitute an erosion of development rights in comparison to the prior plan. I'm saying that, and whether the consequences of this have been adequately assessed. Now, with respect to that latter point, I've considered the rebuttal evidence of Ms. Jones, and as a result, I wish to correct my original statement of evidence. I am now aware that amongst the matters of control in the operative district plan for subdivisions in zones such as the low density residential zone, there is the ability to require upgrades of existing roads, and I've referred to the rule there. While I'm not personally aware of such upgrades having been required by a controlled activity subdivision, it is possible. So I now believe my comment that existing development rights may be substantially eroded by the state's matter. The legal submissions for RCL alluding to development contributions being a superior method to collect revenue to undertake upgrades of the council roading network. In my experience, upgrades to existing roads are usually undertaken by council itself. Council's development contributions policy does allow for bespoke assessments when demand of a development on council infrastructure is considered unusual and not properly encapsulated by standard assessments, which I understand include scenarios where development is having a clear implication on an intersection of a road that can be separated, I should say, for example, an intersection of a road that can be separated from other demands on the network. Now that may, we can come back to this point in relation to your most recent question. So in summary, while I believe that Section 42A's reports amendments to limit required upgrades to the vicinity of the site is an important, it is an improvement over the proposed plan, it would be much more efficient and no less effective if such upgrades were limited to improvements to within the site and adjoining roads, which is more precisely defined.
Maybe if I was to put the question to you on this,
yes.
Mr. Wells.
Yes.
You've said right at the beginning, you've got a preference to state the minimum car parking requirements.
Yes.
Now, to breach that requires a consent.
Correct.
Would it be reasonable for the plan to contain provisions that that it would be appropriate to grant such consents where alternative offsetting provisions were provided?
Yes, and I think that would be positive thing. I do anticipate that happening, and that would be appropriate.
My understanding is that the traffic generating activity rule is actually the same thing, but formalised in terms of various activities. So you're suggesting you'd sooner take it on a case by case basis, but provide the ability for the council to achieve the same outcome, but through the consent. That consent process when people chose to not provide the minimum parking?
Yes, and I think I touched on that in my evidence, that it is my preference that you sort of establish a baseline of what a contribution, for want of a better word, of car parks is. But I think it would be useful if the plan encouraged people to, on all sides of the fence, to critically assess that and consider alternatives. But I think that fallback is very useful for understanding what obligations are. We pick up the plan and read it, or in my instance, advise somebody, put some clarity around this is what you should expect to do. You might be able to reduce that if you pursue other means. But I think that provides the kind of certainty that is useful. Now, and just one point you raised there, whether it is sort of one and the same thing, and if I'm following where things have got to properly with the recommendations of Ms. Jones, I think she would recommend that if you go over a threshold, you don't actually have car parking provisions, minimum car parking standards, instead you're into the a more sort of case-by-case assessment.
Yes, in terms of substitution arrangement.
Yes, you're sort of not substituting against a known quantity, if you know what I mean. I think
right.
It is useful to continue to have that baseline.
Right. And would it equally be suitable, given that high traffic generating activities, the ones that like to have more car parking, to put in maximum car parking levels and have the same arrangement if those are to be bridged?
Sorry, you were asking me whether maximum car parking ratios,
yes,
are an appropriate
an appropriate alternative in a way to ensure that the transport network is not overwhelmed.
That's an interesting question because it might have an effect on managing demand creation, discouraging car use or ownership, perhaps. It doesn't necessarily deal with the effect of cars spilling out onto the street, which is quite a common concern. And if there's an under display of cars, say, in a residential environment, street. The street's becoming very cluttered, being an amenity issue, sometimes becoming a functionality issue. It's a bit extreme. But look, I do think that that can, in some instances, be an appropriate provision, but emphasis on some instances. And if I go back to RCL as an example, in a kind of suburban sort of environment, I don't think it works there. It needs to be quite intensive areas that, you know, close to, you know, key public transport routes and things like that.
Look, when bringing your evidence in chief, engagement with the issue of traffic generating activities, similar issues were in the previous submissions as well regarding Jack's point on Henley Down. Is it your argument that effectively the traffic generation issue is fully dealt with through the zoning, the exercise of zoning the land in the first place, or is that too simplistic?
In that particular case of thinking again RCL, a recent plan change established a structure plan that set out the road network, relative priorities, set rules around constructing intersections at certain trigger points. Yes, and that has been done. I think there probably would be a case that it has been pretty well covered off there. So that probably works both ways in terms of making it less necessary to have rules to extend to reconsider those points, but also reduces the risks for RCL that they would actually be used to require upgrades. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Right, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Wells. The wording of the assessment matter is 209871. So you're saying that the wording of the rebuttal version is somewhat improved, but it could be more improved, better improved, if it were just limited to within the site. And now, in your summary, you've added the words "and adjoining roads." Now that doesn't seem to be what was in your evidence, or is that a sort of concession that you're saying that sometimes the immediate joining road, maybe at the entrance or whatever, could sometimes be included?
Yes, I'm grappling with that. I'm sure there is quite a precise definition that can be landed on. I wrote that recently.
I'm not taking
it away, don't worry. I accept it. What I'm trying to get to is where your access.
Yes.
Clearly, the intersection where you enter into your site, that should be within the scope of an assessment so that you've provided adequate access, which I think is in the subdivision chapter. I think it's when you start, you can sort of draw a line at that point there. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean by adjoining roads. So maybe those words are actually unnecessary because the site probably includes that access.
But that's what you're meaning, though.
Yes.
Because I'm certainly, in my experience, that's quite often those works can be differentiated to the effects of that development and done often by the developer as opposed to by the council.
Yes, and I think they should be.
Yeah.
That's a very direct connection. I think you start to lose that. It becomes difficult to establish that very direct connection as you get further and further away.
The section down and down.
Yeah. Yes, I think so.
All right. Well, that's fine. I just wanted to be sure I knew what you were asking for. You talk about, in one of the paragraphs, 27, about subdivision being excluded from the list of activities deemed to constitute a high traffic demand activity. And there may be some question as to whether it is or isn't in this district plan, proposed district plan. And are you familiar with other high traffic generating activity rules in other areas as to whether or not they tend to include subdivision as well as land uses? Or if you're not, don't worry. But
yes,
I'm just interested.
In other districts, do you mean?
Yes, like Christchurch and Auckland, we know have high traffic generating rules.
Only vaguely, not familiar enough to really give
useful
advice on that.
That's all right.
Yeah.
And you, I mean, this is just the last thing that you raise is this matter about whether or not there are assessment matters or not, and I just want, because you've raised it, which is interesting to me, am I right in noting that even within chapter 29 and certainly between chapter 29 and some of the other chapters, sometimes there are assessment matters for restricted discretionary and sometimes there aren't?
So chapter 29 is what, sorry?
The transport chapter.
The transport chapter at the proposed
transport chapter. Some restricted discretionaries, MRIs, or have you noted, some restricted discretionaries have assessment matters and others don't. They just have matters of control in the rule itself.
I think that's correct. I mean, but Ms. Jones might be better to give you a definitive answer. But
you've mentioned the need for a consistency.
Oh, sorry, I follow you now. The point that I'm picking up here is that in stage one of the plan, when it started out, there was a real drive from the discussions I had with those that were writing it to achieve a more concise plan. And at that point, when they notified the plan, I don't believe in stage one, there were few of any assessment matters.
The rules are in for subdivision.
They were still there, were they? Okay, all right. I just remember dealing with I worked on the Millbrook zone, and at one point I made a suggestion to put it in a single assessment matter, and the staff were like, no, we're staying away from those. And now they do appear to be coming in quite a lot.
There's been a rollover of staff.
They have. And it's not to say it's right or wrong, but I am generally a fan of trying to just get as concise as we can. So I'm just encouraging, I suppose, the commissioners to look at that critically, whether there might be an opportunity to perhaps remove them if they can be incorporated back into the matters of discretion, etc.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you very much. That's all my questions.
Thank you. All good, thanks.